I love that, the brain tickling, the daydreaming, the kind of forming stuff in your mind before anything really solidifies. I love getting the story down and finding out more about my characters and letting them grow and blossom and really become part of my heart.
Welcome to Writes for Women, a podcast all about celebrating women's voices and supporting women writers. I'm Pamela Cook, women's fiction author, writing teacher, mentor, and podcaster. Before beginning today's chat, I would like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the Dharawal people, the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is being recorded, along with the traditional owners of the land throughout Australia. And a quick reminder that there could be strong language and adult concepts discussed in this podcast, so please be aware of this if you have children around. Let's relax on the convo couch and chat to this week's guest.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Writes for Women. Today, it's Thursday, the 20th of March, as I'm speaking, and we have a great guest on the podcast today. It's someone that I have spoken to on the podcast when her first book, The Last of the Apple Blossoms, came out. Mary Lou Stevens is also a guest host from time to time on the podcast, and we actually got to meet in real life a few weeks ago when she came out for the launch of her book, The Chocolate Factory. And when I say came out, she actually came to Australia because Mary Lou is currently doing a slow travel around different parts of the world, which I find absolutely fascinating. And we talk about that in the course of this interview, where we also talk about The Chocolate Factory. I'll tell you a little bit more about Mary Lou in just a moment. I've just come back from a fabulous meeting with my writing group, The Inkwell, colloquially known as the Inkies, and we always have a fabulous writing session where we share what we're doing with our writing. We share articles that we've listened to, podcasts that we've listened to, all about writing. We talk about different things that come up in workshops or webinars that we've done. We do some feedback, giving feedback for each other on blurbs or chapters or whole stories at times. So it's a fabulous supportive group, and I wouldn't be writing without them. You've heard me talk about them on the podcast on many occasions. But today, one of the things that came up as a result of actually a webinar that Jane Friedman had on her website, and you can check that out. I think it's already been. I don't know if you can actually tap into the resource there, but it was held by Tiffany Yates Martin on the Jane Friedman website. And it was about secrets, twists, and reveals. And the discussion at the Inkwell came on the back of a podcast I listened to called The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. And a fabulous podcast. I'll put a link to that in the show notes, where a couple of agents and an author have combined forces. And the agents look at queries, talk about the queries, and then also pull apart the openings of the books that writers send into them. So there's lots of book discussion, lots of really hands-on book discussion, and there's some great tips to be had there. But this notion of twists and reveals and openings and how we introduce the character to the reader gave me pause to think about this whole idea of narrative perspective and point of view in our writing. So it's just something I wanted to talk about quickly as a bit of a writing tip or thought for this week. And this is this idea of who is actually telling your story. Obviously, you are the writer and you are also the narrator. And in some sense, you're also the character. You're creating a character and you're filtering your words through that character. Now, depending on whether you write in first person, third person, close point of view, omniscient point of view, there's going to be some decisions you have to make about what you reveal to the reader and at what point. So I always like to say, and this isn't my own idea, I've read about and heard about it in other writing places and courses, but think of your lens, if you like, the lens that you're looking through the story at, as either a wide angle camera, a medium angle, or a real zoom in. So we might often start a story because we want to introduce things to the reader. We might start with this kind of wide angle lens and give an overview or a perspective. Now, I think one thing you need to decide is how close is your connection, or how close is the narrator's connection to the point of view character going to be? So if you start with something like a very broad overview, let's take a classic opening line from Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Now, that's obviously an omniscient narrator. telling the reader something about the time setting that this story is set in. When you have an omniscient narrator, they have the power, or even any outside narrator coming in, they have the power to tell things to the reader that the character might not know about in advance. So it's almost like you have the narrator as a second character telling the reader things, and then you're showing the reader things through the character's actions. So we need to think about how close we want to get to our character in terms of point of view. But if you want a really close connection with the character, you want the reader to have that really close connection, and there almost be no kind of barrier between the point of view character and the reader, we essentially need to minimize that outside narration as much as possible and go straight into the point of view character's experiences, thoughts, feelings. And if you want to be really close, there will essentially be no secrets as such between the reader and the character. So in true deep point of view, which is what I aim to write in, and it is really hard to pull off for a whole book, there are times of sometimes when you need to come back out of that point of view in order to make things clear for the reader, but you need to do that in quite a seamless way. But if you really want to be deep point of view, the idea is to be fully in the character's skin. So the character will be revealing things to the reader quite up front. We're going to be in that character's head from the word go. Not obviously in the character's head all the time, but we want to be knowing what that character is thinking, feeling, doing, and we want to know the character's motivations if they're aware of them. Now, this is where you can play around a little bit with deep point of view, because there will be experiences from the character's past or perhaps even in the present that they don't want to acknowledge, they don't want to talk about, they don't want to even think about. So if any thought like that comes up in the point of view character's head, they might then immediately go and do something else or do a different action to divert themselves from thinking about that. You can use this kind of deep point of view perspective as a way of showing that there is something in the character's mind or subconscious that they don't want to reveal, like a series of breadcrumbs that are sprinkled out there, and the reader will follow them. And eventually, because we're putting the character under pressure, they will reveal whatever that is. So that's a great way when you're writing in deep point of view to actually build up to some kind of reveal where the reader knows that there's something going on for the character because they've hinted at it, but then they've shied away from actually revealing that. Similarly, with first person, that is direct access to the character. It's first person, it's I. So it's up to the character then to decide how much they're going to reveal in the telling of their story. And they might not want to reveal everything up front. There's going to be things that they hold back, and those things that they hold back are going to be integral to creating tension and suspense and pulling the reader through the story in terms of getting them to turn the page and find out, why aren't they telling us more about this? Why are they shying away from that? Why is that issue not being addressed here up front by the character, whether it's third or first person? Going around in a little bit of a circle with this, but just think about, in terms of the narrative perspective, how close do you want the reader to be to your character? Do you want them fully inside their skin? Do you want them sometimes inside the skin and sometimes just slightly out and maybe sitting right on their shoulder? Do you want them to be at times completely outside, so we are looking onto that character with a more objective viewpoint? You can play around with that. And this is also a really good thing to notice in books you're reading. If you're a writer, it's always great to read as a writer. Analyze how your favorite authors do that and have a look at how is the narrative perspective working in the stories that you're enjoying. Let's get on to the chat with Mary Lou, but before we do that, I will tell you a little bit about her. Mary Lou Stevens was born in Tasmania and studied acting at the Victorian College of the Arts and played in bands in Melbourne, Hobart and Sydney. She's had the most amazing career. Eventually, she got a proper job in radio, where she was a presenter and music director, first with commercial radio and then with the ABC. She received great reviews for her memoir, Sex, Drugs and Meditation, published by Pan Macmillan in 2013, the true story of how meditation changed her life, saved her job and helped her find a husband. Her debut novel, The Last of the Apple Blossom, was published by HarperCollins HQ in 2021, and The Chocolate Factory has recently come out in the last couple of months, right now in 2024. Mary Lou has worked and played all over Australia. She's now slowly travelling and writing mostly. So let's get on and chat to Mary Lou. It's a fantastic chat with her, and we cover so many things about the writing process, the writing life, how her own experiences in life have informed her writing, including her attendance at a Quaker school when she was younger and her quite interesting religious upbringing. And also we get on to talking about her slow travels, which are just absolutely fascinating. So sit back, grab a cuppa, pop your walking shoes on, whatever it is you do when you listen to Writes for Women. And don't forget, you can also watch the videos on YouTube. There is a YouTube channel you can subscribe to. So if you feel like sitting down and watching a video instead of listening to the podcast, find that at Writes for Women on YouTube. And don't forget that the transcripts are also available on the website, writesforwomen.com. And also don't forget that you can become a Patreon supporter of the podcast, just as Mary Lou is, actually. And you'll receive a monthly bonus. Now, this month's monthly bonus, which if anybody signs up before the end of March, I will get that out to you, even though it has already gone out to the Patreon supporters, is basically a little tutorial from me analysing four different openings of books and talking about what gives them hooks, what the hooks are in these openings, what makes them great openings, what I find really interesting about them, and a little bit of analysis on the writing. I'll be doing different types of videos each month as the bonus for the family Patreons. I might be doing book reviews. I might get on and talk about my writing process. I might do critiques, as I've done this month, of published works. I could even critique your work, if that's what you wanted, as a Patreon subscriber, and do that and provide feedback that then other people can share and learn from. So have a think about becoming a Patreon supporter of the podcast if you're not already. It helps me to pay for the editing, the distribution, for my fabulous VA, Annie Bucknell, and it just means that I'm able to keep the podcast going and coming out weekly as it is currently doing. So it's only the cost of a cup of coffee per month, $5, and it shows that you support the podcast and love what I'm doing here and what the guest hosts are doing here at Writes for Women. That's it for the intro. Let's get on to the chat with Mary Lou. Mary Lou Stevens, welcome to the Writes for Women Convo Couch.
Hello, Pam. Here we are, back in virtual reality.
Back in virtual reality after actually meeting last week at your book event at Better Read Than Den for the first time. We actually met in real life, IRL, as they say, which was wonderful. And that was a great event with Claudine Tonellis from Talking Aussie Books doing the hosting. And we had a lovely catch up afterwards with a number of writer friends. So it was really nice.
And I felt as though I already knew everyone because we've done so much on Zoom over the years. And it was just like, is this really the first time we've met in real life? Because I feel as though I already have, but we hadn't.
No, it's so bizarre, isn't it? And I have to say a massive thank you to you, Mary Lou, too, as I mentioned in the intro, for your support of the podcast over the years. You've been a fabulous Patreon supporter and you're always supporting the podcast on social media. So I really appreciate that.
I love what you do. It's easy to support it.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, before we get into talking about the Chocolate Factory and all the research involved, because I'm really fascinated. It was fantastic to hear you talk about that at the event last week because there is so much great historical detail in this book. But before we start, so everybody knows what we are talking about, could you tell us what The Chocolate Factory is about, although the title does give it away somewhat?
I don't have a copy of the book, but I have this.
Ah, beautiful.
A lot of The Chocolate Factory is about this. This was the most popular chocolate in the world in the early 1900s. George Cadbury Jr. invented it in 1905, and it was quickly the subject of the chocolate spies. So everyone wanted that recipe. It was kept in a vault, and if you knew it, if you worked at Bonneville and you knew it, then you had to sign a legal declaration saying that you would never, ever divulge the recipe. So I knew this, and I also knew about the Cadbury's factory in Tasmania and grew up in Hobart. How could I not? But it started in the early 1900s. And I thought, what would happen if the chocolate spies trying to get their hands on the dairy milk recipe thought they might have an easier time of it in Tasmania? And so all the industrial espionage that was happening in the UK between the chocolate factories, what if that came over to Tasmania? So I have two main characters. Dorothy has been working at Bourneville for many years, and she's been handpicked to help start off this new factory and train the new staff. And there's Maisie, who is a local Hobart girl. She's only 18. She's been working for years. Everyone started working so young back then. And sees a job at Cadbury's as her way out of poverty and to help her family and to make sure her younger sister can stay in school instead of having to go to work. And so Dorothy is Maisie's trainer. She has great hope in her and she's rising up the ranks when all hell breaks loose, pretty much. There's been a few kind of signs that things were going off the rails, but then bang. Everything happens. They're caught up in this plot. There's blackmail, there's intrigue, there's suspense, and there's also romance. Like, I do love a good love story in there as well, and there's a couple of them. But it boils down to everyone, including the Australian manufacturers, wanting to get their hands on the recipe for this.
And I am fully in support of that because dairy milk is actually my favourite. I always say to people at my family, don't buy me an Easter egg, just buy me a block of dairy milk and I'll be happy. It's my absolute favourite. So I was really drawn to the book for that reason, and many others. But this is, of course, your second book, Mary Lou, following on from The Last of the Apple Blossom, another fantastic story about, was the beginnings of the apple industry, apple growing industry in Tasmania?
No, it's actually the demise.
Oh, it was the demise, wasn't it? Sorry, yes.
It was the apple aisle for a long time, but from the 60s through to the 70s, it all the wheels fell off the whole thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a while since I've read it, so thank you for that reminder. But I know for that first book, you had been working on that for quite a long time and before you, of course, got your publishing contract with HQ at HarperCollins. And then you were contracted for this second book. How different was the experience of writing a book? I know already how it's going to go, but because we've talked about this, but you had all the time in the world, of course, to write the first one and submitted it when you felt it was ready and it had lots of work and you had mentoring with Monica McInerney and all that sort of thing. But this was a different kettle of fish, wasn't it?
Look, luckily, I'd already done all the research for The Chocolate Factory. So when they offered me a two-book deal, Last the Apple Blossom was a one-book deal, and then they offered me another two books and said, you'll have all the time in the world to write it, meaning a year. Yeah, I can actually do that. I can do that. But I got the deal on the strength of a synopsis and three chapters. And so that was a completely different playing field. Because as you say, I was used to taking all the time in the world, having a finished product, seeing if anyone wanted it. This time writing to contract, it's just, I've got this synopsis, which I really liked because I already had a very strong idea of the story and my characters before I started writing. And I thought I better stick to it, even though I know a lot of authors do pitch a synopsis and then go off on other tangents and stuff. But I liked this synopsis. But it is completely different writing a book to a deadline and knowing that it's going to get published. Mm. It's a very different space. And when I was editing The Chocolate Factory, I was writing the next one and I had never been in that position before because Chocolate Factories has come out, The Jam Maker's coming out next year. So to be in that position that I know a lot of authors are in and friends of mine are in when you're on a book a year contract gave me such a new respect for those authors because it's tough. Mm. Plus I was slow traveling through Asia at the time. I wasn't at home.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that too.
But I just went, wow. And to be quite honest, at the end of it, my husband said, please don't do that again. Spent most of my time in a room working and it's a very different experience.
Yeah. Did you find it stressful having that pressure of knowing you had that contract looming and the deadline looming?
Look, I'm so good at hitting deadlines. My job at the ABC, it was deadlines all day, every day. You go into work and you just have to hit deadlines to get a program together and breaking stories and guests and this and that and the other and not having a lunch hour and just powering through. So I'm good at that. And I think my slightly kind of control freak brain just goes, bang, you know, this is what we're doing. We get it done.
Right. Yeah. You've got to have that mindset, haven't you, really? Because like you say, you've got that very condensed period of time.
What I did miss was I did a masterclass at the RWA conference many years ago, Kate Forsyth, and she talks about how she daydreams a book into existence for a year. She doesn't even write anything down for that first year. So if I'd done the research and I was daydreaming my book into existence while I was doing the research, but having that real luxury of time, yeah. I think if, and that's happening with me now because, yes, I'm doing the edits for next year's book, but I'm just, my brain is being tickled. My brain is being tickled and there's no stress and there's no pressure and there's no deadline. It's just it's nice. So when you get a new idea and you're thinking about yeah. your character, what could possibly happen, it's like a delicious time.
I love that brain being tickled. I love that phrase. It's great. So as you say, a lot of authors have this experience, particularly if you are on a book of year that you are editing one book, drafting the next. How do you go about mentally taking, separating those two? And of course, it's a completely different story and set of characters and everything, possibly a different vibe. But did you have any ways of really switching headspace around those two processes?
I would keep them completely separate. I know people sometimes will be writing one book in the morning and editing the other one in the afternoon. I could not do that. I can't, you know, put my brain into different compartments like that. I would have a bit of an idea when the edits came in. And when one round of edits were about 3 weeks late, I must say it did throw me off because we were traveling and I'd set myself up to be in this one place and to receive those edits and to do them there, and that got blown out of the window. But yes, if I was editing one book, that's what I'd be doing. And then when that was done, I would get back to writing the other. But I tell you what I have found really interesting, and this is when people want book a year, I don't know how you do this, but I'm promoting The Chocolate Factory and I've written a whole other book since then. I'm going,
yeah. Oh,
now, oh, is that in this book or is that in that book? Because they're both, all my books are set in Tasmania. They're all foodie fiction. They're all historical. So I'm going, oh, now, what part of Hobart are we in? And is it Maisie or is it Harriet or, you know, that?
Yeah.
That's tricky.
Yeah, that would be hard, actually, because it's like for you, that book's done. You've finished it. You've moved on to the next one. But now, like you say, you're having to talk about it again and publicise it and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, which has been glorious and it's been fun and it's meant lots of this.
I know. I partook in that chocolate last week. It was very nice. Thank you very much. So you mentioned then that your stories are all set in Tasmania. Of course, you grew up in Tasmania.
Mm.
Spent time there, very familiar with it. What was it about this particular story, The Chocolate Factory, that kind of grabbed your writerly imagination and you thought, was it the spy angle? That's what grabbed you? Or was there, were there other things that really grabbed you and thought, that's what I want to write about?
I really wanted to write about Cadbury's. I remember the tours I used to do there when I was a kid and that complete sensory overload. And as writers, we're always being told to include all the senses. So being in a chocolate factory, bang, they're all there. The smell is overpowering, the sound, the heat, the taste, everything is there. And everyone who's done one of those tours will never forget it because not all the smells are good. In fact, at the early stages of chocolate making, it smells dreadful. It's horrible. So that's a smell that stays with you too. And I talk about that in the book, how it changes the process. There was that. And when I found out about the chocolate espionage and how Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was inspired by the truth of Roald Dahl knowing about the espionage that was happening when he was a boy, he went to a boarding school near Cadbury's. The boys were taste testers for Cadbury's. They visited the factory. So Roald Dahl had a lifelong love of chocolate because of that. So in the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and Grandpa Joe says to Charlie the reason that Willy Wonka has shut the gates and they're locked and you don't see workers coming in and out is because of the chocolate spies. I went, okay. They're all trying to steal Willy Wonka's recipes and so he just gets rid of everyone. Cadbury didn't resort to that, but they certainly did employ chocolate detectives to try and root out the spies who posed as employees trying to steal their recipes. There was that and there were the Quakers. And this is really the part that touches my heart. I went to the world's largest Quaker school, which is in Hobart, My grandparents were Quakers. My great aunt was known as the Peace Angel. She was the Quaker activist in the First World War. And I really wanted to write a book about Quakers. I felt more and more in line. I feel more and more in line with their philosophy the older I get. And I thought, not everyone is as fascinated with Quakers as I am. But the Quakers started all the big chocolate factories in the UK. They Cadbury's, Roundtree's, Fry's, Terry's, all Quaker families, because of their history with encouraging people to drink hot chocolate, hot cocoa instead of alcohol. Temperance is a Quaker.
Ah, okay. That's the connection, right?
That's the connection. Yeah. Because back in those days, water, town water would probably kill you. So people were all drinking beer, small ale, even kids. And so the Quakers went, this is a real problem. Society is falling apart because everyone's drunk. There's this healthy new drink, cocoa, hot chocolate. Let's make it free, not freely available, but cheap and available. And the water is boiled, so it's not going to kill people. So that's what they did. And they sold it and they encouraged people to drink it. And that's how they all got into being chocolate makers. Yeah.
So fascinating. It's really amazing. Yeah. And I was really interested that the Cadbury factory wasn't just a Cadbury factory. It was Fry's and Pascal as well. So it was like a conglomeration. Is that right?
Yeah. So Bourneville in the UK, just Cadbury's. They had, by the time they came to Tasmania, merged with Fry, but their business was worth a lot more than Fry's. So Fry's kind of just got absorbed. And Pascal, they got on board as well because they needed a lot of money to fund a brand new factory. So halfway across the world, down the bottom. So it was Cadbury, Fry, Pascal when they came out. And then through the decades, it just became Cadbury's. But it was a consortium of three. And out of all the founding families, it was actually a Pascal who came out at the start. And so there was some suspicion that he did that to try and get his hands on this. Everyone's under suspicion in this book, I'm just telling you.
Yeah, which is great for the tension. I love it. I love it. So you've got your idea. You do a lot of research. Do you do a whole lot of research before you sit down to actually start writing? How does that part of the process work for you?
Yes, I do. And there's a reason for that. It's because the research in part informs the writing for me. So I will have this overarching arc of the historical points. Most everything that happens in this book, which, you know, like the water or the scaffolding accident or this, that or the other, they're actually true things that happened. So then when I'm writing the book, I pin my characters' stories and their responses to these historical events. So I don't call myself a plotter, but I would say having that scaffolding already in place is like being a plotter, but I actually don't know how my characters are going to respond to these events until I start writing.
Yeah, so you've got that kind of factual scaffold and then you're building the fictional kind of building around it, aren't you, on top of that? Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
Then I have a fabulous editor who then queries a lot of the factual stuff that's in there.
Yeah.
So I go, okay, I think that's right. I researched this, but I'll go and double check and, oh, yeah, actually that's right.
Okay. So you've got, as you mentioned, two protagonists, Dorothy and Maisie, and they come from quite different worlds. Obviously, one's Dorothy's come from England. Maisie is a local girl who gets a job in the factory. But tell us about each of them and how you went about developing their characters in line with all the factual research that you've done.
Dorothy came from some fabulous academic papers, mainly one by Emma Robertson. So there are a couple of academics who'd written papers and theses. There's quite a few of them. And it was the same with The Last of the Apple Blossom. People had written a lot of academic papers about the demise of the apple industry. And so finding them and reading them, but especially Emma's, which was about, in particular, about the group of women who came out from Bourneville. These very experienced workers who are all four women who'd been given promotions to come to Tassie as well. And so Dorothy was just built out of their stories in a way. And she has a completely different story arc to them. but I knew about the women coming from the different companies, from Pascal's and Fry's, as well as Cadbury's. I knew their positions, what they were brought out to do. I knew where they lived. I knew that there was a matron in charge of them to keep them safe. The Cadbury's were very concerned about keeping women safe out in the colonies. And I could get a really great idea from the photos and also the stories and the historical research of what these women did, how they lived. And from that, my research, because there's backstory about Dorothy and her life in Bourneville. So there's a bit about Bourneville in there as well and the things she did and how she lived there. And there's certainly a lot of history about Bourneville. And I was very grateful to these academic papers because there are history books about Cadbury's, but they don't really have much on the Tasmanian factory at all. It's all about what happened in England. And so to find these academic papers and then to find the heritage officer in Melbourne, Bruce Smith, what a gem he is, and for him to be able to gain access to the archives back in England at Bourneville and send me stuff was, yeah, just a gem. Now, Maisie, it's 1921 when the book begins, and it's a hard time, not only in the UK but Australia after the war. There's still rationing, there's poverty, the returned soldiers can't find jobs, and the war widows, of which there are many, get a pension, but it's a pittance. Mm. So they're struggling to survive. And also the fact that if you were lucky, you stayed in school until you're 14, which if you were bright, what did that do? A girl just had to go off and be in domestic service or whatever. So I thought, what if for her motivation, if her sister is about to turn 14 and has to go to work, and Maisie, who's the oldest of the three children, thinks, I want her to have a better life. She's very bright. Lily is very bright, and I want her to be able to succeed. And she can see it's the 1920s. Women have the vote in Tasmania. They still don't have the vote in England. Women of a certain class have the vote in England, and Maisie's not 21 yet, so she doesn't have the vote. But there's still a lot of space opening up in Australia. There's a female member of parliament. So things are really changing very quickly in Australia. And Maisie wants her little sister to have a chance in this changing world.
I love that you gave her that motivation. And it is such an interesting time period, isn't it? Because that post-war time period where, as you say, everybody's still experiencing trauma from the war. So there's all that, and the changing role of women coming into the 1920s, but also still very much being the second-class citizens. But working in the factory gave the women kind of sense of independence, didn't it?
Yes, having their own money, being able to make their own way, and Cadbury's especially treated their workers very well. The Quakers also really big believers and supporters in education. So at Bourneville, if you did start work at 14, you would get paid to go to school a day a week until you turned 18, and then there were other things in place, evening classes, night school, very strong. So they brought that in Tasmania as well, once the factory got up and running, and encouraged the girls just as well as the blokes, if not more so, to go to evening school so they could advance their chances of promotion. There are still a lot of young women who saw marriage as the way out, and so there was a much higher turnover of girls rather than the men who would stay. But still, they were given every chance, and they could see that there was a different kind of possibility for them if they chose to go down that route.
Are you someone who does character bios and things, Mary Lou, or do you just learn about the characters as you write? How does that work for you? Hi everyone, it's Pam here. Sorry to interrupt Mary Lou, but this is a little word from our sponsor, which is actually me, and in fact my writing retreat that's coming up in May, from May 16 to 19, the Next Chapter Writing Retreat. You may have seen this advertised on Instagram or Facebook or come across it on my website, pamelacook.com.au, but I really want to let you know, if you are in Australia, or perhaps even if you feel like flying into Australia for a fabulous writing retreat in May, there are only two spaces left. So the writing retreat runs from Thursday the 16th of May to Sunday the 19th. We are going to be covering all sorts of things, from characterization, plotting, You will have some time to write. We'll be looking at putting tension into your writing. We'll be looking at writing in scenes. And I will be sharing a whole lot of expertise that I have gained in over 20 years of writing, and also bringing my teaching experience to the fore in this writing retreat. We've got a fabulous bunch of women writers, and I'm really excited to be able to be doing this writing retreat in Currajong at beautiful Currawina House. If you'd like to find out more about the retreat, pop onto my website, look under the courses page at pamelacook.com.au, and be quick if you're interested, because as I said, there are only two places left, and it is going to be an absolutely amazing retreat, fully catered in a beautiful location, and I just cannot wait. Would love you to join us there for the next chapter writing retreat. Back to Mary Lou Stevens talking about her characters and whether she does bios or whether she just learns about them as she goes.
I do character timelines about Dorothy. I do it more in my head than write it down. And it's more emotional than clinical black and white, this, that, and the other. It's more of a feeling. I very much operate off emotion. And someone said to me the other day, actually a couple of people said this to me, you don't actually describe your characters physically very much. It's just like a rough sketch.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And I think it was actually, yeah, it was the chocolate factory. And my editor went, can we have just a bit of physical description?
You know what? I mean, I think that's great in a way, because it's leaving room for the reader. You're giving them all the information about this. We learn so much about the characters. So, you know, what's wrong with the reader coming up with the picture in their head?
Yeah, and I think because I do work very much from that emotional core, I know what they're like emotionally. Mm. To me, their appearance is secondary. Maisie's hair is like a dad's. It's hard to control. That actually becomes just a little bit of a plot point later on. And Dorothy has dark hair, which she keeps neatly behind. She's worked in a factory. Of course, she has to keep her hair neat.
Yeah.
And she has this little habit of doing this, which becomes a plot point later on. So little things like that I will put in if they're important to the story.
Yeah.
But there's this very funny story. My first job in radio, I worked at 2TM and I had to work Christmas Day. So this is in Tamworth. And I was at the radio station all on my own. And the doorbell rings and I've got a song on. So I go out to answer it. And there's this woman there with this full Christmas dinner. And she says, oh, this is for Mary Lou because she has to work Christmas Day. And I thought she'd love a Christmas dinner. And I went, that's fabulous. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And she says, no, it's for Mary Lou. I'm like, I'm Mary Lou. He says, no, you're not. Mary Lou is short, dark curly hair. And I was like, actually, she's not. She got pissed off at me. She was annoyed.
How dare you look like yourself?
I wasn't the person she had painted in her head from my voice. And I think perhaps that stuck with me somehow is I'll let my readers just have the description they want of this person from the emotional description that I'm giving. And if suddenly, halfway through the book, they find out that Dorothy has blonde hair, which she doesn't, you know, they might have that jarring effect. That woman in Tamworth, she was not happy.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. How dare you? So we've got Dorothy and Maisie, protagonists. Who are a few of the other people that we meet in the story?
There's Sarah. She works in the office at Cadbury's. She's very different to the rest of the women who stay in the hostel. So Sarah, she goes off to work in town while everyone else goes to work at the factory. And she's really an aid to Dorothy in many ways. And when Dorothy needs a friend, she's there because relationships in the hostel start to break down. Prompted by a real cow of a character called Esme. And it's always fun to write a cow.
Yeah, I bet she is fun to write, yeah.
I had to give her one little saving grace. It did not last long. We also have Gertie, who's Maisie's friend, who was a joy to write because it is the 1920s and women are starting to bob their hair and there's movie stars and all that kind of stuff that people think of the 1920s. They think that's what's happening, when in reality in Tasmania it was not happening. Things were pretty dire. So Gertie is there, but she's this kind of bright, shining, and she's got blonde hair. She does. And I describe it getting cut. There's the physical description there.
I have to say, Mary Lou, I loved that because my grandmother's name was Gertie.
Oh.
And she was a really fun person, a real character. So I really was channeling her as I was reading Gertie.
Yeah. And we have Ida, who is Dorothy's best friend. And through her, we get a sense of the history that they've had together at Bourneville and what they've gone through. Because Dorothy is a war widow. Her beloved Freddie died at the Western Front. There's friction between those two, which goes through the book and is one of those kind of little sad sore points that kind of worries. Oh, God, I feel like crying, but it does. It worries away through the book. And anyway, there's that. I get so emotional about my characters. and then there are the men. So there's Thomas. Dorothy meets him on the boat out from England and she realises that something's not quite right. And so she vows to help him with that. And he does remind her of her late husband. So she has a particular attachment to him. And for Maisie, there's the lovely Frank. And there's another love interest as well, who's a very good-looking young man who loves chocolate. And so those stories are all intertwined. Thomas was an interesting character to write, and I needed to be particularly sensitive there because he does have shell shock. And so I did a lot of research on shell shock, and I was horrified about a lot of the stuff that I read about how those men were treated. During war, they were often shot as cowards. When they came home, they were often stuck in asylums. They were ridiculed, dismissed, and they had to do their best to keep it hidden or keep themselves hidden to avoid being locked up. And the various forms of treatments were as ridiculous as eat porridge every day or just get over it. There was a hospital in Devon that was doing great work with being outside in nature, working the land, farming pretty much.
Right.
Just getting the men outdoors in and out of cities and giving them jobs to do and out of everything that worked. But Dorothy researches all this kind of stuff because of Freddie, because of Thomas, and that's woven through the book as well.
Yeah, I love the way you weave those different threads through the story. There's a lot of depth. There's a lot of layers to the story.
But there's a lot of stuff going on. Plus, she was a Cadbury's angel during the war. The Cadbury's turned two of their buildings at Bourneville into hospitals and everyone volunteered. And so Dorothy has had some experience with shell shock victims in those Cadbury hospitals and caring for them. So it's not as if she's completely half-cocked.
And interesting that you were saying just before, Mary Lou, about being emotional, getting emotional at the thought of the friction between the characters. But I think that is so important that as the author that we have that emotional connection to the characters, because getting that onto the page is then allowing the reader to make that emotional connection, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And I do. And I can't write a book without it. There's no point in me writing a book that I'm not that emotional about. With the last of the Apple Blossom, I cried on every single page. It was just such a flood of tears. And with this one too, I would get so emotional while I was writing. And when you are writing a book, it's a couple of years out of your life. So for me, it's not something that I can just do with my head. My whole heart, my whole being has to be there to sustain me through the entire process. With historical fiction and with other fiction too. I'm researching for a year, I'm writing for a year, then there'll be editing. You really need that kind of soul sustenance to carry you through.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. One of the things, Mary Lou, that I wanted to mention to you and to talk about is obviously there is a lot of research, there's a lot of historical detail in your stories. And one of the things I really noticed particularly, well, I know you did it in Last of the Apple Blossom too, but as I was reading this recently, The Chocolate Factory, is the way that you use dialogue to really let the reader know a lot about that historical detail. So and in this case, because Dorothy is very experienced already in the whole chocolate making process, so she's come from England, she's already got that knowledge. But it's part of her role to impart that knowledge, isn't it, to the other characters? So that must have been a great vehicle for you to be able to then get that historical detail in through the dialogue, and you weave it through so beautifully. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Two things about this. So one, I love dialogue, and I think it comes back from my days as an actor, where you're working with a script and it's all dialogue. There's maybe a little bit of stage direction, but that all comes from the director and from your character, or the blocking and stuff like that. To start off with, you're just working with dialogue. There was one chapter in The Chocolate Factory and I was editing it and I realised it was all dialogue.
Oh, really?
Nothing but dialogue. And I went, okay, I think we better put a few different elements in here. I do love it. And as far as weaving the historical research in, my first commissioning editor who worked with me through The Last of the Apple Blossom, she was forever telling me that I'd got stuck in a bog with my research and to just pull out swathes of stuff. And I was just these little markups on, you know, in track changes, bog, bog.
I love that, bog.
Get rid of it. Don't care, not interested. And she messaged me after it was clear that The Chocolate Factory was doing really well, and she was so proud because she's the one who'd commissioned it. And she said, and I've read it, and she said, your writing has improved so much.
Oh,
you are weaving this detail through seamlessly and in interesting and entertaining fashion. So that was high praise indeed from the woman who just wrote, bog.
Yeah, you've come a long way. You're out of the bog. But I think, as I said, because of the setup in this book, it really was the perfect way to get that information across, wasn't it? And I imagine in your edits, you then had to go through and still probably pull some out and cut back or whatever. But yeah, it is a great vehicle for getting information across, I think, no matter what genre you're writing.
Yeah, I do love it. And I think now that I've written three historical novels, the third one will be out next year, it's just knowing, I have a better idea now of how much research to do, how to use it, what to do with it, which with The Last of the Apple Blossom, it was my first historical novel. And honestly, when I read the first draft, I was bored with the amount of research was in that me, which found everything about apples fascinating. But I was just reading it going, oh, my God, chuck that. Pull that out. That goes away. So my first drafts aren't as research heavy. Which is good for me and good for everyone else.
Yeah, brilliant. What's your preference, drafting or editing, revision?
Oh, gosh. That's really interesting.
Because some people just love that whole getting into the flow of the draft and just being lost in that whole story meandering around, whereas other people really prefer that more meticulous process of pulling it apart and putting it back together.
I'm racking my brains here. It's quite obvious, I'm sure. Because I love that the brain tickling, the daydreaming, the kind of forming stuff in your mind before anything really solidifies. I love getting the story down and finding out more about my characters and letting them grow and blossom and really become part of my heart. And I'm editing next year's book at the moment. And it's quite exciting because I haven't seen it for months because my deadline was December and I just got my edits last week. And so it's a whole new experience with this book and getting to know these characters and the story again and having my notes here. And my commissioning editor wants a few things changed and this explained more and this expanded. And so I'm working out how to fit it in. But in the meantime, I'm becoming reacquainted with this story and going, oh, I like this. I really like this book. So I do not have a clear answer for you.
Okay.
I would say that every aspect of it fascinates me, and it's the business end when the book is out and the rubber hits the road. I'd say that's where the tricky stuff really starts. It's out of my control. There's not a lot I can do about it. I can do some things, but not really a lot. But in this whole imagining and writing and even with edits, and I love being edited. I love it when someone just picks up on something or goes, you know, this, and I go, oh, yeah, of course. So I love having that input. So, yeah, that's all the stuff I love, the process. From woe to go. I love it. It's fantastic.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
Do you revise as you go when you're drafting, or are you someone that starts at the beginning and just goes through to the end?
Yep. I'm chronological. The only time I haven't done that is in my memoir, which is a two-timeline thing that came out 2013 with Pan Macmillan. And I'd have chunks of stuff. I use Scrivener, which I love. So I'd have chunks of stuff in the binder just going, where is that going to fit in? Where is that going to fit in? Where is that going to fit in? But with this historical fiction, and it's all been one timeline, that may change in future books. But if I'm just doing one timeline, then I'd like just going from the beginning, finishing at the end. And I just keep writing. If I need to research something, I'll make a little note. I won't research it at the time. I just keep writing. If I think something's not working, I'll leave a little note. I'll just keep writing. If I think it needs something added here, I'll leave a little note and just keep writing.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. It fascinates me the way everyone has such a different process. There's overlap a lot of the time, of course. Some people write a scene, go back, revise the whole thing before moving forward. Others, like yourself, just keep going beginning to end. It's so interesting to me that we all have a different process and often changes for each book.
Yeah, well, with the memo, like I said, it was different, but I did write three practice books before I got published. And one of those is the dual timeline, but even that's pretty much how I operate. It may change in the future.
Do you think any of those books will ever come out of the drawer?
Nah.
No. I love that. No thinking about that. No.
Nah. I know. With the first one, quite a few people are disappointed. And I did work for a long time on that book and I had a mentor and people loved my main character, but its time has passed.
Right.
For me. And as I've said, that emotional attachment, I think people who've read it are more emotionally attached to it than I am now, because I've gone on big journeys with other characters to other places. And I have so many more ideas just tickling around. I want to move forward. I don't actually want to go back to those books. It's like that's just a different part of my life.
And you would be a different writer now to the way you wrote then too.
I do love my memoir and it's stood the test of time. And when it got remanded, I republished it myself. So it was because I didn't want it to disappear. I wanted it still to be available. I earn about $5 a month, if I'm lucky in that. But it's still out in the world. And, of course, it's my memoir. So I have a huge emotional attachment to it. But the books that my practice books, that emotional attachment is gone.
Now, I want to get on to talking a little bit about your slow traveling, but I found it really interesting, Mary Lou. Obviously, we've talked a little bit about the Quaker element of the book. I remember when you started preparing for your slow travels and you were packing things up and selling basically everything to go on the road and do this lifestyle of slow traveling. And then last week, particularly at the book event, hearing you talk about the Quaker influence in your life, it really struck me and it made more sense to me in terms of what you are doing now at this point and your ability to let go of those physical material things that you did let go of in order to do this slow traveling. Can you talk a little bit about that and how much that kind of Quaker upbringing and those influences on your early life, how that is still with you? And do you think that is part of your, this kind of ability that you have had to just take to the road and see what happens?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I went to a Quaker school, but that was very different to my upbringing. Quakers, there's no hierarchy. Everyone's equal. You go to the meeting room. It's a philosophy. It's not a religion. So there's no rites or rituals. You just sit in silence. And if there's the light of God within you urges you to speak, you stand up and speak. My home life was very different. And those who've read my memoir will know this, that it's Pentecostal, I guess. It was called Charismatic Movement. So it was speaking in tongues, healing the sick, prophecy. It was all a bit crazy at home for a lot of the time. The Quaker influence in my family had actually gone by the time my parents were on the scene. And my dad became a born-again Christian at a Billy Graham crusade.
Wow. Okay. So you've had quite a few different influences going on there. Yeah.
I would say what really influenced my love of decluttering, it was before Marie Kondo. And then someone said to me, this is Swedish death cleaning, but I didn't know it had a name back then. But my father had died. He'd left behind when he was 61. I was in my 20s and he had left behind so much stuff. And then my brother died and he was 52 and he left behind so much stuff. And then my mother died and she didn't leave behind as much stuff. But when you are going through someone's belongings after they've died, and it's stuff that they have held on to for a long time, and you're going, well, it must have been precious to them. So what do I do with it? Mm. It's so hard just to throw it out or give it away. It meant something to them. Am I supposed to keep it? And quite honestly, Pam, I didn't want to. I'm going to cry now. Mm. I did not want to do that to anyone else. I didn't want anyone else to be left with my pile of stuff going, what do I keep? What do I throw out? And feeling bad about it and not knowing. So when I left the ABC, I became the queen of decluttering. My husband had to start nailing stuff down, otherwise I'd give it away. And the Swedish death cleaning, which I did learn about later, is you don't leave anything behind that could possibly hurt anyone who is left behind. So there's that whole emotional aspect to it as well. And when I finally went, yeah, let's go slow traveling, it took me a while to get my head around it. My husband was very keen from the get-go. And I went, okay, yeah, let's do this. One of the most exciting things for me was we're going to get rid of everything. I finally get to get rid of everything. And that's what thrilled me most. And slow traveling isn't for everyone, because a lot of people are attached to stuff and to their things. And I had one friend who was so attached to me having things that she said, you can't give everything away. There's got to be something for you to return to. I've got a big house. I will store some of your stuff for you. And so to keep her happy, I said, yeah, sure, you hang on to some of my stuff. But I was not attached to it. Really not. There's a few little bits and pieces, but not a lot.
I just find it so interesting. So you said your husband was really keen on it from the get-go. We're the same, around the same age. I'm guessing as we get older, we start to think about what we want to do with our life, the bucket list, all that sort of thing. But what was it in particular about slow traveling that really appealed to you?
When I left the ABC, which was some years ago now, my husband said to me, what do you want to do next? And I said, all I want to do is travel and write. Now, we are low income earners in Australia. We have super, but it's not a lot. So he went away and thought about it and came up with a plan, which involved bicycles and a tent, which is how we could afford to do travel around Europe and everywhere else. And I just went, that's not happening. Then we met some friends who were house sitting around the world, and that's the work. That's how a lot of people do it, how they afford it. They house sit. You need good references, so we house sat locally. We got some great references, and then after one particular house sit, my husband went, "No, this isn't for me. You are living someone else's lifestyle choices," which is very true. You have their pets to look after, their house to look after, their garden to look after, and it's not necessarily the way that you would choose to live. So we were stymied, but my husband is a very good researcher. He does most of it on YouTube, and he found these people traveling the world with this thing called slow travel. And because you go to places that are cheaper than the place where you usually reside, because if you stay in one place for long enough, then you get big discounts on accommodation. And because you're not spending a fortune on airfares because you're staying in one place for so long, it becomes very affordable. So he started talking to me about this, and I was still not convinced, and I had a book to write and then he showed me a particular video of a couple. Now, most of these slow traveling people with their YouTube videos, they concentrate on budget and geography and food of the places that they go. But this couple talked about the emotional aspects, the relationship aspects, the mental health aspects, the spiritual aspects, all the things that are important to me. Mm. And I listened to them and I went, now I get it. Now I'm interested. So I said, okay, let's do this and let's get rid of everything.
Amazing. So is it a year now that you've been going, or a bit longer?
It's a bit longer now, and we're heading off to South America next for an indefinite amount of time. We're learning Spanish because a lot of the places we go, no one speaks English. And I was a little bit homesick for a while, and what I really missed was talking with other writers. I missed my writing groups, but so many things were pointing us along the way of leaving Australia our car died. And I'm much more than that. A member of my riding group, and there were only three of us at that time, died suddenly. And it was just such a shock. And I went, yeah, it's time to do this. Mm. It's time to go out in the world. None of us know how long we've got. I'll get rid of all my stuff so no one has to go through it, and let's go into the world and have adventures for as long as we can.
Oh, it's lovely. It's so exciting. I'm traveling vicariously through you, so there is that. But you've been in Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, anywhere else?
Yes, Thailand twice, Philippines, spent a lot of time in Sarawak, which is an independent Malaysian state on Borneo, and in Malaysia itself. So it was all Southeast Asia, and it's interesting, and I always look into the history of wherever we go, and it's always fascinating and heartbreaking in a lot of ways. So now, yeah, South America, which is a very big place, lots of countries, some of them not as stable as others, but we're starting in Uruguay, which is the most stable, the most progressive, and the most expensive. So we'll see how long we want to stay.
Yeah, yeah. So what's a typical writing day look like for you there, Mary Lou? Is it any different to a typical writing day here, apart from being in a different place?
No, it's just the same. And that's what I said to my husband before we set off. My days are going to look pretty much like they look here. I'm going to be in a room on my own writing a lot of the time. Are you going to be okay with that? And it wasn't really until almost a year that he got a bit restless because I was working so much. But I'd always have the weekends off. And because we were staying in one place for so long, that was plenty of time to have a look around, see the sights, go to a zillion temples, all those things. Go to the beach. I have yet to see one, which is even a patch on the beaches in Australia. So I still had lots of time because we weren't rushing around like tourists. We're travellers and we're slow travellers. So even though I was working a lot, I still had that time. But my husband said, please don't do that again. Please don't write a book and edit a book in the same year. And I went, no promises. We'll see.
Yeah. So you've got a bit longer than a year for the next one or not? It is a year time frame.
So the 2025 book is written. I'm editing it now. And the next idea is just doing it, singing in my brain, but there's no pressure to write it. I did have lunch with my latest commissioning editor and she said, I've got to ask you what's next. And I said, it'll be 2026 by then and AIs will be writing all the books by then and who knows what's going to happen. And this does break my heart. I make a joke of it.
Mm.
But we don't know with this AI thing where it's heading or what's going to happen. And my editor was at that lunch meeting and she said, yes, and all the editing may well be done by AIs by then as well. Which is another heartbreaker for me because, as I keep going back to, it's the emotional connection about the work that is the most important thing to me. And there are some people who are saying AIs are sentient already, so maybe they will have an emotional connection to their work. We just don't know. They're writing their own code. We have no idea where this is heading. But my commissioning editor persisted and I said, I'll tell you what, I'll get my AI to talk to your AI and we'll figure something out.
I love it.
I'm going to keep writing.
That's what we do.
But I hope there will still be a place, and people keep reassuring me that there will be a place for books written by people. Yeah.
I certainly hope so. You are back in Australia at the moment on the publicity trail for the Chocolate Factory. How's that been coming back?
It's been fantastic. It's been expensive, but it's also been really easy. Australia is such an easy place to be in. I know how everything works. I know the language. People understand me. I understand them. People obey the road rules almost all the time, which is never a given in Asia. And I'm so grateful at a zebra crossing when the cars stop, because they don't in Asia. So it's incredibly easy. I'm churning through the money, but I knew that I would, and that's okay. I just went, and it's all tax deductible, as is all of this. Being able to claim chocolate on your tax is just fantastic.
That's heaven.
And it's been lovely catching up with people, with family and friends, and just getting a really big dose of it, just soaking up. And I think my husband and I were just a little bit interested to see what would happen while I was here, whether I would actually prefer to stay or, as planned, head off to South America. And I got to say, Pam, my life is not here.
Okay. Interesting.
My life is out there. People say, oh, where do you live? And I say, nowhere and everywhere.
I love that. I love that. Nowhere and everywhere. I think that should be the title of your slow travel memoir when you write it. I'm looking forward to that. I know you haven't said you're going to do one, but I'm hoping you will at some stage.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah.
Who knows? So I cannot remember, Mary Lou, if I asked you this the last time we spoke, but it's a question I always like to finish up with on the podcast, and it sometimes changes from time to time. So what would you say is at the heart of your writing?
My heart. My heart is at the heart of my writing, honestly. Like I've been saying, it's that real heart connection, that soul connection to what I'm doing and to my characters. I get tears in my eyes when I know that I'm at a touch point of truth. And that's what I love, is that emotional touch point there, that this is true. It means so much to me. It's in my heart. It's in my being. It's in my soul. I cannot write a book without that. And yes, I could tell you it's strong female characters in a time when women didn't have much agency. I could say it's about the hero's journey, except it's the heroine's journey. I could say all that stuff that's up here and it's certainly part of what I do. But honestly, there's part of it that I can't put into words that just bring tears to my eyes like it's happening now, because it is this deep emotional connection to the people that I write about and the places that they find themselves in. So, yeah, the heart of my writing is my heart and is their hearts and is the reader's heart, because I really hope for that connection to come through.
It certainly does, Mary Lou. I can assure you of that. And I think that is a perfect place to end our chat, although I could chat to you for hours and hours. So thank you so much for being back on Rights for Women. And I really look forward to the Jam Maker and to hopefully seeing you back here in Australia, maybe next year on the next book tour.
And a deep heartfelt thank you to you, Pam. I know it's a lot of work putting this podcast together, and I deeply appreciate everything you do for writers and readers. It's very much appreciated.
Oh, thank you. That's lovely to hear. Thank you, and happy travelling, slow travelling in South America.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Rights for Women. I hope you've enjoyed my chat with this week's guest. If you did, I'd love it if you could add a quick rating or review wherever you get your podcasts so others can more easily find the episodes. Don't forget to check out the backlist on the Rights for Women website. So much great writing advice in the library there. And you can also find the transcript of today's chat on the website too. You can find details on the website on how to support the podcast through Patreon, and you can connect with me through the website at rightsforwomen.com, on Instagram and Twitter at W4WPodcast, the Facebook page Rights for Women, or find me and my writing at pamelacook.com.au. Thanks for listening, have a great week, and remember, every word you write, you're one word closer to typing the end.